All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, April 13th. Hey, it's Friday the 13th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a chilly 41 degrees, dark and damp, and chilly here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? I had the flu. So thanks to Camille, she gave us an interview with Andre Watson, who is the CEO of a company named Ligandol, discussing personalized gene therapy and some of the things that they are doing in the lab, utilizing nanotechnology and CRISPR to cure what ails you. And today we're going to continue looking at splicing and dicing the planet and self-directed evolution, because it is best for us to be shaped in someone else's image. And it's very disturbing to me. I've had a few days to have quiet time in my head and reflect on some of the things that we talk about on this show. And I got to tell you, it's way more disturbing when your mind is quiet and you're not distracted than if you aren't paying full attention. And sometimes placate, satiate myself and go off somewhere else so I don't obsess on these things. But I have to tell you, we really should be paying attention, because stuff that is happening right now is not going to be good for the future. I came across a few news stories this morning that I'm going to interleave with some of the stuff I've had up here for the last week. This one was out of globalresearch.ca, came out yesterday, April 12, 2018. Titled, U.S. Government Backs Dangerous New Genetic Manipulation of Plants and Animals. Now, this isn't true that this is a brand new genetic manipulation, and this isn't true that it's brand new U.S. government backing, because even in Obama's reign and before that with Clinton, they already were kind of helping fuel the fire for genetic modification. Some of that stuff was happening down at Fort Detrick, Maryland, we found out back in the 80s, and then going on through the 90s, and then Monsanto got into the game. And a lot of these technologies came together, and now we are in the state of, like, evolution of this, where they are doing in vivo experiments to try to cure disease. Because, you know, that's where this is all headed. It's not just about plants anymore. It is about humans. And this is where the big bucks are going to be. So this story out of globalresearch.ca, the Trump administration is now backing a new technology for genetic manipulation of plants and even animals with no intent to supervise or regulate against the possible dangers. Now, we've talked at length about the lack of regulation with some of these technologies. And that 21st Century Cures Act that got passed last year was part of all that, where they were going to fast track cures to be able to get the stuff inside of you. And if left unchecked, it could open a Pandora's box of danger. So I think they already have done that to human health for generations or forever. Yet with very little debate taking place on this dramatic development, here's some things to consider. This new development is called genome editing. Well, it's not new to us, but it is being promoted as a new and improved method of altering genetic expression of plants and even animals and humans. And in 2015, at a London TED conference, Jennifer Doudna presented what is known as CRISPR-Cas9. If you remember, too, Jennifer Doudna spoke at the Joe Biden moonshot, I don't know, it was some big gathering they had on science for curing cancer. And they talked about CRISPR there. Because remember, the cure for the big C is how they're going to get it into everyone. This is a revolutionary and highly controversial gene editing platform using bacterial-driven proteins called Cas9. It is supposedly allows genetic engineers to target and break DNA at precise locations, zip and unzip and insert things or take things out. And in effect, CRISPR is a highly precise way, but don't worry about all the off-target splices, to edit plants, animals, and even humans. And now CRISPR is very precise, not only to mention extraordinarily cheap and easy to use, but it can locate, cut, deactivate, activate, write, or rewrite any sequence of DNA and living material that they want in a living cell. And remember, they have also democratized CRISPR by Adagene, sending CRISPR to 60,000 requests across the planet. And nobody is watching the store. DARPA, the Pentagon's R&D arm, is spending millions of dollars developing gene editing. They are also working on developing, some sort of like file locking service so they can lock down our genome so we can't be accidentally or on purpose gene edited. And James Clapper back in 2016, and we talked about that, he called CRISPR a WMD. Back in July of 2017, DARPA awarded $65 million in a four-year contract to seven teams of scientists to study gene editing technologies. Remember, Georgie Porgy Church is very involved in a lot of that DARPA research. And the commitment officially made DARPA the world's largest government funder of gene drive research. And gene drives were also invested in by good old Billy Gates. Gene drives are the next major development of new gene editing technologies. And remember, gene drives can push a genetic change through an entire population. And this is some of the stuff that they are using with genetically modifying mosquitoes and some of the Oxitec stuff that they are working on. The idea of a gene drive is to force a genetic modification to spread through an entire population in just a few generations. One of the leading gene drive researchers, Omar Akbari, at the University of California, Riverside, gets DARPA gene drive research money. He works with what is supposedly the world's deadliest creature, and that would be the Aedes aegypti mosquito. His work involves gene editing the deadly mosquito and re-engineering them with self-destruct switches. We've talked about this on past shows before. They would be using tetracycline, because it will require tetracycline to live, except that tetracycline is available in the environment through animals that are injected with it. This sounds noble, a boon to mankind, saving maybe a million lives annually. Like selling earlier GMO golden rice as a solution to infant blindness, gene editing, however, is not as perfect as it is made out to be. The scientist who first suggested developing gene drives is Harvard biologist Kevin Esfeldt, and he published a paper warning that the development of gene drives in conjunction with turbocharged gene drive technologies have an alarming potential to go awry. Oh no! He notes how often CRISPR messes up and the likelihood of protective mutations arising, making even benign gene drives ruthlessly aggressive. He stresses, quote, even a few engineered organisms could irrevocably alter an ecosystem. Ding, called planet Earth. His computer gene drive simulations calculate that the resulting edited gene can spread to 99% of a population in as few as 10 generations and persist for more than 200 generations, hence completely screwing up our ecosphere. And it takes a little imagination to conceive a scenario in which a malevolent actor intent on wreaking destruction unleashes destructive gene-edited plants or animals or even humans. We're going to talk about a movie that supposedly is coming out today that looks at some of these consequences. Earlier, GMO was so complex and costly that it was limited to just a very few actors and a few secret labs who grabbed up patents on their GMO seeds. But now with gene editing readily available to Johnny in Mommy's back bedroom and every secret garage down a long dark alleyway, it's become so widespread that Pandora's box is already being opened. The USDA gives a green light, though, so don't worry about that. Rather than approach such a potentially disruptive technology as gene editing with the utmost caution and control, the U.S. government, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, are now opting for zero regulation, a laissez-faire permissiveness that treats the resulting gene-edited plants as identical to conventional plants thereby no needing special regulation. And not that this is brand new news that came out yesterday, though the story was, well, we've been talking about that for a very long time. With the very first CRISPRed mushrooms, they are considered genetically, quote, equivalent. But now with gene editing readily available, we don't have to worry about that because it is everywhere. And in a March 28th press release, Purdue stated that the U.S., and that's Sonny Perdue, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's secretary, the USDA does not regulate or have any plans to regulate plants that could otherwise have been developed through traditional breeding techniques. This includes a new set of techniques that is increasingly being used by plant breeders to produce new plant varieties that are indistinguishable from those developed through traditional breeding methods such as genome editing. So we have the same time the U.S. intelligence agency treating gene editing organisms and related technologies as potential WMDs, while at the very same time the agencies of the U.S. government responsible for food safety, and that would be the USDA, the EPA, and the FDA, seem content to turn a blind eye to it all. As critics like Jules have noted, we might be able to wipe out entire species on a whim, and they are working on that in New Zealand right now with little mousies. And we might be able to do just that to any species that we have decided we would rather not deal with anymore. Even undesirable groups of human beings, big question mark. Well, like I've said, is always a double-edged sword. And I would say, yes, you know, they'll be able to target different individuals or target groups genetically in the future and then just get rid of them. All right, so listen to this. This came up in my news feed this morning when I was scrolling through what I had. This one is out of Stat News. I like statnews.com. Titled, A Giant Gorilla and a Winged Wolf Does Rampage, and that is the title of the new movie, Get the Science of CRISPR Right. Now, I have talked about in the past that someday we might have genetically engineered soldiers that could grow wings and claws and fangs one day, and maybe X-ray vision. My daughter has brought that up to me a couple times before that I've mentioned that over the years. Well, look, now they've made a movie on it. We're here at Stat covering CRISPR a lot, but it is not every day we get to cover The Rock, and that would be the actor Dwayne Johnson. The Rock and genome editing technology meet in a new movie that opens today, Friday, called Rampage. Through a freak accident, a gorilla, a wolf, and a crocodile ingest some CRISPR complexes, and that would be just like we heard in the interview that we aired on Wednesday about encapsulating CRISPR in nanoparticles, and actually his was a peptide nanoparticle made out of a protein. But remember, we spent a lot of time looking at nanoparticles and the ways that they can use lipid nanoparticles and things of that nature to get CRISPR inside of you for quote-unquote therapeutic purposes. So through this freak accident, a gorilla, a wolf, and a crocodile ingest some CRISPR complexes, and these animals whose genomes become edited to make them stronger, bigger, faster, and more aggressive soon wreak havoc on the city of Chicago. Look out, Chicago. It is packed with action, gratuitous destruction, and also an anti-poaching message, along with at least a dozen references to CRISPR, some of which are even accurate, say Stat reporters. So where do we go from here? This is one of the reporters, Megan. She says, I've been working up a Stat pitch on this movie for months, and this movie features both science and The Rock looking contemplatively out over a cornfield. And my original idea was to review the movie with an expert in genome editing. I actually invited four CRISPR experts, all of who were quote-unquote busy. Of course they were. So the movie opens with a title screen that reads, in 1993, a breakthrough new technology known as CRISPR gave scientists a path to treat incurable diseases through genetic editing. And in 2016, due to its potential for misuse, the U.S. intelligence community designated it as a genetically edited weapon of mass destruction and proliferation. It was a huge relief to see CRISPR mentioned right from the get-go, because I really sold the story to our editors, and it made me feel better about expensing Sour Patch Kids and Raisinets when I went to go see it. To get a technical for a second, the title screen is sort of accurate. Yes, James Clapper, then the director of National Intelligence, did list genome editing as a threat in 2016. But when I saw the 1993 timeline, I kind of chuckled to myself, which actually I wouldn't be chuckling too much there, Megan, because even though they said that CRISPR appeared in 2012, they've been messing with this stuff since the 80s. Maybe it wasn't specifically CRISPR, but they had those zinc nuclease fingers and things of that nature that they were tinkering with, and they already had a good start on GMOing plants by that point. This history of modern CRISPR discovery does, by some account, date back to 1993, even though the term CRISPR was not used for another decade or so, and the title page suggests that scientists were using a system of to edit genomes 25 years ago, which we know was not the case. Well, you're wrong, honey. That is much more a recent feat. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, and I should send her that New York Times article where the general from Fort Detrick, Maryland, talked about some of the stuff that they were working on, genetically modifying organisms in the 80s. So, to my surprise, Megan says, the movie started up in space. Well, what is up with that? Well, if you have listened to this show, you know that space is very involved in a lot of these technologies. They're doing a lot of mad science gone mad up in space, figuring out how to make viruses more virulent and how to lengthen telomeres as part of longevity medicine and immortality. And all the rich tech billionaires want to get off this rock eventually after they mess up our ecosphere. So I was not surprised, the author says, whatsoever, that this movie started out in space, but essentially an evil company is testing CRISPR in space on lab rats. Well, maybe, and maybe they're also testing it on humans here on Earth. But only the rat becomes a gigantic rat, and the space shuttle explodes, and the three CRISPR vials fall to Earth. Oh, no. So enter The Rock and his best friend George, an albino gorilla that he rescued from poachers and who he communicates with using sign language. George and the other two animals, a wolf and a crocodile, are quote-unquote infected with CRISPR, and it makes them grow to gigantic proportions and become very aggressive. And in the wolf's case, it also grew bat wings! Hey, I knew it! Now, I predicted that years ago, but that is not how exactly CRISPR works, but it could. I knew that this movie was going to be a good one when one of the astronauts who is trying to escape the shuttle is frantically radioing back to Earth, and someone over the radio chimes in and says, the test subject is a rat, and the astronaut replies, not anymore, he's not. And yes, that is not exactly how CRISPR works, but it is not completely off base either. The idea is that a biotech company weaponized CRISPR research and introduced the genes of a bunch of other animals into our three monster animals to give them traits such as bat wings and spikes of another animal or the strength or regenerative capabilities of all kinds of bugs. And I mean, we've talked about this before, splicing and dicing life and mixing and matching, and that's something that DARPA has been talking about for a very long time. This is all explained very quickly with some exposition by our disgraced yet heroic geneticist, played by Naomi Harris. And I am talking about extremely specific results, says Naomi, who, in my mind, I am on a first-name basis with, which I don't understand that. One question I have is whether or not these animal features are polygenic as opposed to tied to one gene. And that would make it a lot harder to introduce them into another species. But scientists have already CRISPR'd beagles to turn them into super jacked animals, right? So they could be like killer drug dogs. So it is not insane that CRISPR could be used to change the features of an animal. And remember, they are also looking at creating super soldiers that this would be very convenient for. Whether it could be used to double the size of a gorilla overnight, or increase the muscles on a little beagle, well, that might be a different story. And as for the beagles, the CRISPRing happened when the dogs were embryos, not fully grown. But remember, they are working very hard on in vivo walking around genetically modifying living organisms. The CRISPRed animals of Rampage also become super aggressive, and behavior might be harder to change, but DARPA is working on that as well. Maybe they just ramped up testosterone production somehow, or maybe they zippity-zapped a few neurons or created some more, I don't know, adrenaline or something to be produced. I don't know. And Naomi did not quite explain that. All the CRISPR work in the movie seemed to be wildly unregulated. There is no FDA cameo here, and there is no Scott Gitlip in skinny jeans, and there is a Jeffrey Dean Morgan, whom I will refer to as Denny Duquette, his character in Grey's Anatomy. I don't really watch a lot of stuff, so I don't know who any of these people are, but this is just the point, and I'm so happy that they're putting a movie like this out that's going to scare the pants off of people to say, what the hell is CRISPR? He plays a government agent with a faint foghorn leghorn accent who helps The Rock take on the CRISPR company that is called Energene. The best line from the movie says, quote, when science shits the bed, I'm the guy they call to clean the sheets. Well, hopefully we have one of those people in real life, because, guys, this is really stuff that they are tinkering with and stuff that's going on down long, dark hallways under black budgets we will never know about until it is too late. It is Denny Duquette, but yes, that was amazing. In real life, there is a whole system that keeps research in the U.S. involving CRISPR in check. Really? It is called the Food and Drug Administration and the National Institute of Health, and they regulate CRISPR as it relates to medical research. But didn't we just find out in that story that we read before this one that everybody has kind of washed their hands and stepped back and decided to let it go its own course because it's going to make bazillions of dollars? But the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Agriculture also play a role in overseeing the use of CRISPR, and the Department of Defense, which is interested in genome editing as a potential bioterrorism threat and has poured in lots and lots of money, and DARPA happens to be the biggest investor into CRISPR research and gene drives. So there are a lot of people overseeing this kind of work, not just Denny and Megan. You better do your research because they make you think they are, but they really are not. Although the dastardly siblings running Energene maybe found a way around all of these groups that are keeping their eye on things, you know, by like doing their work in space. But is anyone really home at NASA? And remember, NASA is the yin and the yang. It is the yin of the DARPA side of the fence. So don't give NASA a green card, because NASA also has their secrets. And on a different note, this did make me think of a common movie plot. As our colleague Damien Gard wrote last year, Hollywood loves the biopharma villain, and there seems some fear among the public about what scientists can do, particularly when it comes to rewriting the code of life, and I would be one of those people that are afraid of those things. I do wonder if this movie will be people's introduction to CRISPR, and if they're going to go home and Google it, which is what I am hoping. To see headlines invoking designer babies. Is this just going to make people scared of CRISPR, even if they don't know that it probably will not lead to a mutant crocodile that can King Kong-style crawl up Sears Tower? This is totally made up, but I imagine that the marketing people at CRISPR Therapeutics are discussing that right now, and I would also add to that, also probably in China. Side note, the director of this movie 100% took a Chicago architecture boat tour because they hit all the major landmarks. But yes, I do think this will be the first introduction that a lot of people have to CRISPR. And as much as I absolutely love this movie, and I might have to get this when this comes out on Netflix and have my daughter watch it, because she would love to see things that I've talked about for years, growing wings and becoming monsters, play out, especially with CRISPR. And I will be seeing it at least four more times in the theater, but I do think it played fast and loose with some of the science around CRISPR, which is really the thing that actually exists. I know it is science fiction, but the closest thing I could find on the crew list to a science advisor was a genetics lab tech advisor. All right, so do we really want to read more about this movie? I just thought it was great that there's a CRISPR movie where they're creating monsters coming out, and it's really awesome. Oh, here, wait, maybe. I am sorry, but I am still harping on this, but back to the fear of genome editing. Obviously, there are a whole lot of ethical and safety issues involved with playing with DNA, and I think most scientists take this seriously. but it is interesting to see a movie given now that we have treatments on the market, including editing DNA. And sure, they are not CRISPR-based therapies yet, but in China there are. But clinical trials using CRISPR are recruiting patients in the CAR-T therapies that are manipulating the immune system and the gene therapy Luxturna, which is the first I've seen of that, but I'm going to look that up. Are big deals for patients, and there are a lot more coming down the pipe. All right, so now let's take another step. So we've looked a lot at CRISPR over the years. We've been on CRISPR since they first introduced it. We're going to continue on to some of the other bastardization of biology that they are working on in the lab, and they would be creating these, what they are calling artisanal proteins. They are creating proteins that have never been seen in nature before to manipulate biology and maybe even accelerate evolution, like they mention in the next paper I have queued up. So this one in particular is out of 2017, December 26th, from the New York Times, titled, "Scientists are designing artisanal proteins for your body." And what's disturbing about this is that they're getting to levels where they can manipulate cells and chemical interactions between cells, not only splicing and dicing like they can do with CRISPR and inserting things that didn't exist before and making synthetic DNA with those X and Y amino acids that they created to go from ACTG to ACTG X and Y to make alien organisms. But now they are actually manipulating proteins, which are responsible for many of the architectures in the biological organism. And we're going to look in detail at proteins today. So scientists are designing artisanal proteins for your body. The human body makes tens of thousands of cellular proteins, each for a particular task. And now researchers have learned to create custom versions of proteins that are not currently found in nature. Well, that's got to really frighten you. Our bodies make roughly 20,000 different types of proteins, from the collagen in our skin to the hemoglobin in our blood. And some take the shape of molecular sheets, while others are sculpted into fibers, boxes, tunnels, and even scissors. The protein's particular shape enables it to do a particular job, whether it's ferrying oxygen through your blood or helping you to digest foods. Scientists have studied proteins for nearly two centuries, and over that time, they have worked out how cells create them from these simple building blocks of life. And they have long dreamed of assembling these elements into new proteins not found in nature. But they have been stumped by one great mystery, and that would be how the building blocks in a protein take their final shape. Well, David Baker, 55, the director of the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington, and he looks like a mad scientist, I've seen some pictures of him, has been investigating this enigma for nearly a quarter century. And now it looks as if he and his colleagues have cracked it. And thanks in part to a crowdsourced computers and smartphones belonging to over a million volunteers, the scientists have figured out how to choose the building blocks required to create a protein that they will take on to shape the way they want. In a series of papers published this year, Dr. Baker and his colleagues unveiled the results of his work, and they have produced thousands of different kinds of proteins which assume the shape that scientists have predicted. And often these proteins are profoundly different from any that are found in nature. This expertise has led to a profound scientific advance, and that would be cellular proteins designed by man, not by nature. And now we can even build proteins from scratch, from a first principle to do exactly what we want, says Dr. Baker, who's standing looking kind of dreamily into space, holding a buckyball representation in his hands. Scientists will soon be able to construct precise molecular tools for a vast range of tests, he predicts. And already his team has built proteins for purposes ranging from fighting flu viruses, look out, to breaking down gluten in food for all you gluten intolerant people, to detecting trace amounts of opioid drugs for when they're going to be surveilling your blood to make sure you're not doing anything outside of parameters. William DeGrotto, a molecular biologist at the University of California, San Francisco, says that the recent studies by Dr. Baker and his colleagues represent a milestone in this line of scientific inquiry. In the 1980s, when all this mad science was hatching, we dreamed about having such impressive outcomes, he says. Every protein in nature is encoded by a gene, and with that stretch of DNA as its guide, the cell assemblies corresponded protein from building blocks known as amino acids, and selecting from 20 or so different types, the cell builds a chain of amino acids, and that chain stretches dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of units long. And once the cell finishes, the chain folds on itself, typically in just a few hundredths of a second. Proteins fold because each amino acid has an electric charge, almost like little origami DNA nanobots, and parts of the protein chain are attracted to one another while other parts are repelled. Some bonds between the amino acids will yield easily under these forces, and rigid bonds will resist. And the combination of all these atomic forces makes each protein a staggering molecular puzzle. When Dr. Baker attended graduate school, where? Oh, at the University of California, Berkeley, yes, where they're doing CRISPR research, and Jennifer Doudna resides, no one knew how to look at a chain of amino acids and predict the shape that it would fold into. But protein scientists referred to the enigma simply as the folding problem. The folding problem left scientists in the Stone Age when it came to manipulating these important biological elements. Right, manipulation of important biological elements. Proteins that make up cells and biological processes, we sure want to give them all the keys. And they could only use proteins that they happen to find in nature, like early humans finding sharp rocks to cut meat from bones. But we have used proteins for thousands of years. Early cheesemakers, for example, made milk curdle by adding a piece of calf stomach to it. And the protein called chymosin, produced in the stomach, turned liquid milk into a semi-solid form. Well, today, scientists are still looking for ways to harness proteins. Some researchers are studying proteins in abalone shells in hopes of creating stronger body armor, for instance. And others are investigating spider silk. Yeah, remember the spider goats, for making parachute cords. And researchers are also experimenting with modest changes to natural proteins to see if tweaks let them do new things. To Dr. Baker and many other protein scientists, however, this sort of tinkering has been deeply unsatisfying. The proteins found in nature represent only a minuscule fraction of the quote-unquote protein universe, and all of the proteins that could be possibly made with varying combinations of amino acids. So let the mad scientists commence. So when people want a new protein, they look around in nature for things that already exist, but there is no design involved. So now let's involve some crowdsourcing. Dr. Baker has a cheerful demeanor, hair that can be on the verge of chaotic. And yeah, those are some of the pictures I've seen. He looked like he hadn't showered in 2 weeks and it was all sticking up on end. And a penchant for wearing t-shirts to scientific presentations. But his appearance belies a relentless drive. After graduating from Berkeley and joining the University of Washington, where a lot of mad science is going on as well, Dr. Baker joined the effort to solve the folding problem. And he and his colleagues took advantage of the fact that natural proteins are somewhat similar to one another. New proteins do not just pop into existence unless it's in a laboratory. They all evolve from ancestral proteins. So whenever a scientist figures out the shape of a particular protein, they were able to make informed guesses about the shapes of the related ones. Scientists also relied on the fact that many proteins are made from similar parts. One common feature is a spiral stretch of amino acids called an alpha helix. Researchers learned how to recognize a series of amino acids that fold into spirals. And in the late 1990s, A team at Washington University turned to a software for individual studies of complex proteins, and the lab decided to create a common language for all of this code so that researchers could access the collective knowledge about proteins. In 1998, they launched a platform called Rosetta, in which scientists used to build virtual chains of amino acids and then compute the most likely form that it would fold into. The community of protein scientists known as Rosetta Commons grew up around this platform, and for the past 20 years, they've been improving the software on a daily basis, using it to better understand the shape of proteins and how those shapes enable them to work. In 2005, Dr. Baker launched a program called Rosetta at Home, which sounds a lot like the SETI at Home program, which recruited volunteers to donate processing time on their computers and eventually their Android phones. And over the Hoop-and-Doop people, this is trying to figure out how to deconstruct humanity by giving up your free CPU cycles. And over the past 12 years, 1,266,542 people have joined the Rosetta at Home community. Step by step, Rosetta grew more powerful and more sophisticated, and the scientists were able to use the crowdsourced processing power to simulate folding proteins in greater detail. Their prediction grew startlingly more accurate, and the researchers went beyond proteins that already exist to proteins with unnatural sequences. And to see what these unnatural proteins look like in real life, the scientists began synthesizing genes for them and then plugging them into yeast cells, which then manufactured the lab's creations. There are subtleties going on in naturally occurring proteins that we still don't understand, says Baker, but we have mostly solved the folding problem. These advances gave Baker's team the confidence to take on an even bigger challenge. They began to design proteins from scratch for particular jobs. The researchers would start with a task that they wanted the protein to do and then figure out the string of amino acids that would fold the right way to get the job done. One of their experiments, they teamed up with Ian Wilson, a virologist at Scripps Research Institute, to devise a protein to fight the flu. And I wonder if this is working on some of that universal flu vaccine stuff. Dr. Wilson has been searching for ways to neutralize the infection, and his lab has identified one particularly promising target that would be a pocket on the surface of the virus. And if scientists can make a protein that fits snugly into that pocket, it might prevent the virus from slipping into cells. Dr. Baker's team used Rosetta to design such a protein, narrowing their search to several thousand chains of amino acids that might do the job, and they simulated the folding of each and every one, looking for combinations that might fit into that viral niche. So it's almost, I've seen pictures of all these proteins, and they're all different shapes, like little buckyballs and little spiral cages and different things, and all kinds of cells in your body have these little interlocking areas that are called receptors, I believe. And when you get the protein that matches that receptor, dink, it clicks into place. They talked about that in that interview that we aired on Wednesday as well. The researchers then used engineered yeast to turn the semifinalists into real proteins, and they turned the proteins loose on flu viruses. Some grabbed onto the viruses better than others, and the researchers refined their molecular creations until they ended up with one that they had named HB1.6928.2.3. And to see how effective HB1.6928.2.3 was stopping flu infections, they ran experiments on little mousies. They sprayed the protein into the noses of the mice. Oh, and then they injected them with a heavy dose of influenza, which normally would be fatal. But the protein provided 100% protection from death. And that remains to be seen if HB1.6928.2.3 can prove its worth in human trials. So step right up. Quote, Dr. Wilson says it would be nice to have a frontline drug if a new pandemic was about to happen. And this year seems to be one of those years. We have not one but two rounds of super flu. We had H3N2 come through at the beginning of the year, and now influenza B at the end of the year. Isn't it amazing how that happens? HB1.6928.2.3 is just one of a number of proteins that Dr. Baker and his colleagues have designed and tested. They've also made a molecule that blocks the toxin that causes botulism and one that can detect tiny amounts of the opioid fentanyl. Yet another protein may help people who can't tolerate gluten by cutting apart gluten molecules in food. Last week, Dr. Baker's team presented one of its ambitious projects, and that would be a protein shell that can also carry genes. Oh, yeah. This is what they're doing with this stuff, people. They are going to get this stuff into people in order to cure you, except that they are creating things that don't exist in nature. And these are all man-made proteins. This is frightening to me. This is very frightening because I don't see any way to go backwards from here. The researchers designed proteins that assemble themselves like Legos, snapping together into a hollow sphere. And that's why I said it looks like a little buckyball cage. And in that process, they can also enclose or encapsulate genes, even CRISPR, that can carry cargo safely for hours into the bloodstream. These shells bear some striking resemblance to viruses, though they lack the molecular wherewithal to invade cells. We sometimes call them, quote, not a virus, says Dr. Baker. And a number of researchers are experimenting with viruses as a mean for delivering genes throughout the body. And that would be like that adenovirus we have talked about where they suck all the guts out, they put in their payload, and then they infect the organism. And as that virus infects cells in the organism, it releases its payload, like CRISPR, into the body. These genes can reverse hereditary disorders. Of course, it's all for your own good. And in other experiments, they show promise as a way to reprogram immune cells to fight the big C. But as the product of billions of years of evolution, viruses often don't perform well as gene mules. If we build a delivery system from the ground up, it should work better, says Dr. Baker. So Gary Nabel, the chief scientific officer at Sanofi, which is a pharmaceutical manufacturer, says that the new research may lead to the invention of molecules that we yet even can't imagine. It is new territory, he says as he rubs his hands together, because you are not modeling existing proteins. You're making new ones. But for now, Baker and his colleagues can only make short chain proteins. Phew. But that is only due to the cost involved in making pieces of DNA to encode these proteins. But that technology is improving so quickly that the team is now testing longer, bigger proteins that might be able to do way more complex jobs, among them, including fighting cancer. In cancer immunotherapies, and that big C is going to be exactly how they get this into people, the immune system recognizes cancer cells by its distinctive proteins on its surface. The immune system relies on antibodies that can recognize only a single protein. Dr. Baker wants to design proteins that trigger a response only after they lock onto several kinds of proteins on the surface of a cancer cell at once. He suspects that these molecules will be able to recognize cancer cells while leaving healthy ones alone, or so he hopes. And essentially, he says, we are designing molecules that can do simple logic calculations. Indeed, he hopes eventually to make molecular machines. Our cells generate fuels with one such engine, and there'll be a gigantic protein called ATP synthase, which is a kind of molecular water wheel, and I believe ATP is the engine of the cell. And as positively charged protons pour through a ring of amino acids, it spins at 100 times a second, and ATP synthase harnesses that energy to build a fuel molecule called ATP. It should be possible to build other such complex molecular machines as scientists learn more about how big proteins take shape. And there's a lot of things that nature has come up with just randomly by bumbling around. As we understand more and more of the basic principles, we ought to be able to do much better. Now, guys, you don't see a lot about protein design and manipulation in any of the articles much right now. There are only, I don't know, I think it maybe pulled up 5 or 6 of them, but I've been looking at this for a while. One of the things that's disturbing is that a lot of this stuff is going on in the research labs right now, and this is even bigger than CRISPR, because CRISPR just kind of cuts things, splice and dice, and allows you to insert, zip and unzip, or cut out faulty genes. This is actually affecting the manipulation and the biology of the cells being able to latch on to things and cause self to do things with man-made proteins that have never been seen before in nature. So, all right, here's a publication out of Germany, I believe. This was some conference going on back in 2004, which surprised me. Actually, this is October 2002, but the paper was 2004. It's a European journal called ChemBioChem of Chemical Biology. And one of the things that caught my attention was them talking about evolution. Now, where is that? This kind of little squishy print. Protein design. This issue of ChemBioChem consists of peer-reviewed contributions from speakers who participated at the 86th International TDC Conference in Germany, which was held in the town of TDC in the Black Forest of Germany during the October 2002 meeting. This meeting entitled, and here we go, Protein Design at the Crossroads of Biotechnology, Chemistry, and Evolution, was sponsored by the Boehringer Ingelheim Fonds and organized by Franz Xavier Schmidt and Reinhard Stirner. And with the advent of the site-directed mutagenesis in the 1980s, the routes to optimizing existing proteins and designing new novel ones with desired stabilities and the catalytic activities seem to be wide open. However, many of the earlier attempts to tailor proteins by tinkering were unsuccessful, but this reflects the fact that the structural basis of protein stability and enzymatic catalysts was still largely enigmatic, but about that same time, it was found that many microorganisms and their proteins can thrive in boiling water and or in dilute sulfuric acid. This discovery left little doubt that conventional proteins carry enormous potential for improvements with respect to stability and function. The lessons taught by proteins from extremophilic organisms were well taken by the protein design community. For example, sequence and structure comparisons were employed in attempts to identify stabilizing residues or regions, which were then grafted from thermophilic to the mesophilic by directed mutagenesis. However, many of these approaches and everything else is all kind of blurred out, so I can't read any more of that. But the fact of the matter was, this publication was from 2004, and this was presented at a conference in 2002. They'd already started tinkering with some of this stuff in the 1980s, just like I had suspected. Now, let's get back to proteins. We're going to look at some basics here for the last few minutes of proteins. What is the difference between a peptide and a protein? And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because in that interview on Wednesday with Andre Watson on personalized gene therapy, he had talked about using peptide-based nanotechnology. The nanoparticle was created from a peptide and encapsulated CRISPR. Proteins and peptides, and I always thought that a peptide was a protein, but it's a form of protein. They're actually smaller than proteins. Proteins and peptides, this is out of EncyclopediaBritannica.com. Proteins and peptides are fundamental components of cells that carry out important biological functions. Proteins give cells their shape, for example, and they respond to the signals transmitted from an extracellular environment. Certain types of peptides play key roles in regulating activities of other molecules. Structurally, proteins and peptides are very similar, being made up of chains of amino acids that are held together by peptide bonds, also called amide bonds. So what distinguishes a protein from a peptide? The basic distinguishing factors are size and structure. Peptides are smaller than proteins, and traditionally, peptides are defined as molecules that consist of between 2 and 50 amino acids, whereby proteins are made up of 50 or more amino acids. In addition, peptides tend to be less defined in structure than proteins. which can adopt complex conformations known as secondary, tertiary, and quaternary structures. And functional distinctions may also be made between peptides and proteins. Peptides, however, may be subdivided into other things such as oligopeptides, which have very few amino acids, and that'd be 2 to 20, or polypeptides, which have many amino acids. Proteins are formed by one or more polypeptides joined together. And in fact, some research uses the term peptide to refer specifically to oligopeptides. And this is getting a little more detailed than I wanted. All right, let's move on to another publication out of Nature.com about protein structure. Proteins are the end product of decoding processes that start with the information in your cellular DNA. As the workhorse of the cell, proteins compose the structural and the motor elements of the cell, and they serve as the catalyst for virtually every single biochemical reaction that occurs in a living thing. So shouldn't we be frightened that they're working on creating custom proteins? This incredible array of functions of proteins derives from a startlingly simple code that specifies a huge diverse set of structures. In fact, each gene in cellular DNA contains the code for a unique protein structure, and not only are these proteins assembled with different amino acid sequences, but they are also held together by different bonds and folded into a variety of different 3D structures. The folded shape or conformation depends directly on the linear amino acid structure of the protein. The building blocks of the protein are amino acids, which are small organic molecules that consist of an alpha carbon atom linked to an amino group, or more often called a carboxyl group, and a hydrogen atom in a variety of components called side chains. And within a protein, multiple amino acids are linked together then by peptide bonds, thereby forming a long chain. Peptide bonds are formed by biochemical reactions that extract water molecules as it joins an amino group from one group of amino acids to the carboxyl group, and blah, blah, blah. I'm just trying to give you a little background here as to how critical proteins are to living things. I mean, they make up the machinery of life. So where do we go from here? So there is a wiki listing for protein engineering. Protein engineering is the process of developing useful or valuable proteins. It's a very young discipline with much research taking place into the understanding of protein folding and the recognition of protein design principles. It is also a product and services market with an estimated value of $168 billion as of 2017. There are two general strategies for protein engineering. One would be rational protein design, and two would be for what? Oh, directed evolution. Yes, Georgie Porgy Church has talked a lot about directed evolution as well. These methods are not mutually exclusive. Researchers will often apply both. And in the future, the more detailed knowledge of protein structure and function and the advances in high throughput screening, it may greatly expand the abilities of protein engineering. Eventually, even unnatural amino acids may be included via neuromethods, such as expanded genetic code, and that might even allow encoding novel amino acids in our genetic code. So, there's a couple other things I want to talk about. Protein folding. What caught my attention is that one of the things I know about protein folding is that malformed proteins have been investigated as the cause for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's disease, as well as that Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease and mad cow disease as well. So let's just give the mad scientists the ability to create new proteins never before seen and to fold them in different ways that we have never known about and see if it starts making Swiss cheese holes in our brain. Well, the University of Washington researchers now are investigating the roles of malformed proteins in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's disease. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's disease may have more in common than their effects on the function of the brain and the spinal cord. The finding that this common thread could lead to a treatment for all three of these diseases. A recent study by David Smith, associate professor of biochemistry, suggests that the heart of all these diseases may be misfolded proteins that are shaped in a similar way, and he has now published his findings in the Journal of Nature Communications. Neurodegenerative diseases are characterized by the progressive deterioration of the central nervous system, the brain, and the spinal cord, which can lead to a decline in cognitive functions such as dementia. But neurons, which are the cells that carry messages throughout our body, cannot be regenerated. Some of the most common neurodegenerative diseases are Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's. Well, now scientists have known that there has been a link that exists between neurodegenerative diseases and protein buildup in the neurons. However, no good studies have ever found a reason to explain why the cell protein degradation systems do not work well. And that is where our study comes in. His research focused on the shape a protein takes rather than its type and how that may contribute to the disease. Smith, the scientist who is also a member of the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, discovered that when excess proteins adopt a particular formation and accumulate in a neuron, they sabotage the neuron's proteasome, or in Smith's word, the protein degradation machinery. He compares it to a garbage disposal with a gate on top so it can't get out. And normally shaped proteins are crucial to neural functioning, and without them, the body cannot build and maintain neurons that officially transmit information to and from the brain. Abnormally shaped proteins may clump together and form molecular complexes called oligomers, which are toxic to neurons and inhibit the proteasome. And what's very frightening about this is, who's to say the protein design couldn't be a WMD at some point in the future that starts wiping out everybody's brain? Well, we're going to look at a very last story, and we got the very last few seconds. This is out of a publication called evolutionnews.org. Titled, this was yesterday, titled Protein Folding and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And it caught my attention because that's about what this is, guys. They are dealing with technologies that we shouldn't even be touching with a 10-foot pole, and especially when there isn't any type of real oversight or regulation going on in a lot of these mad science laboratories. One of the most significant projects for the intelligent design movement was Douglas Axe's research test on the rarity of folding proteins. Axe's method represented the most accurate approach for addressing the problem to date, but it was actually on one line of studies that concluded that amino acid sequences forming stable proteins found in nature are exceedingly uncommon. And as a consequence, most proteins seen in life could have never have originated via random mutations and selection. So one of the earliest online critics of Axe's work was Arthur Hunt, who wrote a lengthy critique at a Darwinian advocacy site called Pandora's Thumb. His area of expertise is not the evolution of new protein folds, and his argument revealed a general misunderstanding of Axe's approach. So, hey, let's just start folding our own proteins that we make around and see what happens.